Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Vira Sachenko, and I'm a host today on the channel. I will be speaking with Carlo Bonomi about his exciting recent book sequel, The Cut and the Building of Psychoanalysis. These books record decades of research into the history of psychoanalysis, dynamics of trauma, and psychoanalytic theory and teaching. They were published by Routledge in two volumes in 2015 and 2018. Today we speak about the first volume, subtitled Sigmund Freud and Emma Eckstein. Carlo Bonomi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm very glad to make this interview with you.
Carlo, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how you found yourself on the path of psychoanalysis.
Well, I'm Italian. I was born in Parma, and then I came to Florence, where I am still living, to study philosophy. And I studied philosophy, especially phenomenology. And then during these years, I began to be interested in psychoanalysis as well, especially because I became acquainted with a friend, Nicholas Rand, and his family, Maria Torok, who was at the time a very famous psychoanalyst, and Nicholas Abram, who was interested in phenomenology and became a very famous psychoanalyst as well. And he wrote about phenomenology and psychoanalysis, and that I began to be interested in psychoanalysis as well. And but it is quite important, the beginning of my studies, because it's connected with my research. Then after studying philosophy, I studied also psychology. And I was trained by an Italian institute in Florence, who is called Sullivan, and his approach is interpersonal psychoanalysis. And then when I began to study psychoanalysis, probably because of my background, I began to be very, very puzzled by the lack of a credible narration regarding the origin of psychoanalysis. The canonic and hagiographic account of its origins was, at the time, it was in the 80s. I'm speaking of the 80s. At the time, it was no longer viewed as reliable. And there were many, many new revisionist books, but they aimed only to identify the fallacies and the contradictions rather than trying to understand their hidden logic. And then I was really, really puzzled, and I start to accumulate questions in myself.
Yeah, so this really brings us to the first question about the book, is what really motivated you to do this research and eventually to write about this in the books?
Yes, this my combined interest in the field of philosophy and also psychoanalysis and an approach to psychoanalysis which was highly influenced by the teaching of Maria Torok and Nicholas Abraham. And then they were also, Nicholas Abraham was also the one who rediscovered Thalassa, the main work of Ferenczi, and published in France in the 50s or beginning 60s. Their origin was Hungarian, and they were very, very fond of Ferenczi. They were very close to the people who later gave impulse to the Ferenczi Renaissance. So also the approach to psychoanalysis, to Freud, I approached Freud passing through Ferenczi, and this gave me quite another perspective. If you read the clinical diary, there are many observations on Freud, on the personality on Freud, of Freud, on the problem of Freud and counter-transfer, which were very illuminating. And then when the first volume of the correspondence between Freud and Ferenczi appeared, this was in 1992, it appeared in French, the first volume, and then that was really the starting point of my research. I was very impressed by certain dreams of Ferenczi, which made me have a sort of fantasy about the beginning of psychoanalysis.
Is there a particular dream that you would share about this?
Yes. There was a particular dream. It was just an image. A cut off penis was served on a sort of saucer of cup. In German, it's Tasse, but then Ferenczi also made it. Drew it as a plate, this small penis, erect penis, and this dream was I cannot enter here in the details, but I began to think that it was just a sort of repetition of another very famous dream of Freud. I turned my attention to the dream book by Freud, interpretation of dreams and his dreams, especially this dream of self-castration by Freud. And then I began to have a fantasy that is that the entire psychoanalytic edifice was rested on a catastrophic event related to a real castration. This was just a fantasy, nothing more. But what did I do? I decided to pay visits to Professor Gerhard Fichte, who was the director of the Institute of History of Medicine at the University of Tübingen, and also a very respected authority on Freud, to discuss my hypothesis, namely that young Freud might have been impacted by some event of real and actual castration.
Right.
And so Professor Fitter was at first very perplexed. He blocked himself. But then after a few minutes, we went in the Institute's library and he collected for me a pile of German books and articles on the subject of the castration of women and the circumcision of children during the second half of the 19th century.
Right, and this critical medical context you elaborate in the first part of the book is really shocking. Could you outline a little bit about how the practice of female circumcision and circumcision of children and genital mutilation became a favorite treatment?
Yes, to enter in detail in this topic would require a lot of time, but we can simply say that that to my amazement, I discovered that it was normal practice for hysteria to be treated by gynecologists by means of various surgical procedures, such as amputation or scarification of the clitoris on sexually mature women, as well as little girls, and as well the removal of ovaries that was especially on mature women. Because the ovaries were discovered as the organ that regulated the sexual life, and hysteria was traditionally connected to sexual life. Hysteria comes from the Greek uterus, and a new scientific theory began to spread during the 18th century about the effect of sexual organs on the nervous system, and this was combined with the social phenomenon that we call the great fear of masturbation. This great fear of masturbation began to spread during the previous century, but it for a long time was only concerned only young men. It did not concern women and children. But after mid of the 18th century, this great fear began to spread in a new way, and the new object were women and girls.
Right, you say, I think, that children's sexuality was in the air, or that suddenly people discovered that children were masturbating.
Exactly. But this masturbating was considered something very, very dangerous, very dangerous. And the means to cure this severe this severe sickness was became more and more cruel. Initially, it was the treatment was very mild, consisted in especially in nidrotherapy. But then, from the half of 18th century, surgical means began to be applied, and also other kind of mechanical restraint, but especially surgery, and especially with women and girls. The cutting of the clitoris became very, very very popular. And also the castration, the word castration in the years when Freud began, invented coined the term psychoanalysis, the term castration was used only to describe this gynecological treatment of hysteria in women.
That's very interesting. And did you find that these were particular women? Who were these women and children? Were they of a particular class or standing? Were they people who were isolated by means of being at an asylum?
No. It was bourgeois people. It was high people from high society, people who could have access to the best doctors. Just to make an example, in Vienna, the General Hospital of Vienna was founded at the end of the 18th century, and the first pediatric department was opened in around 1870, maybe a few years before. And the first head of the pediatric department in Vienna, Ludwig Fleischmann, published one of the most shocking articles about the discovery of masturbation in very, very young children. That is in 1 year, 2 years. And recommending also recommending operation such the cutting of the clitoris and or the scarification of the clitoris, cauterization of the labia, and or at a certain point he writes also even for babies who are soigling, that means sucking infant who are still taking the milk, for them it is sufficient a cauterization at the entrance of the vagina. Imagine this was the head of the first pediatric department, and of course only people of bourgeois people had access to this kind of authority. It was a medical authority, and of course this has much to do with my story, with the story that I'm trying to have tried to narrate, because the main patient of Freud in the period when psychoanalysis was born was Emma Eckstein, and she was, by the way, the only female patient in those years who had a treatment that lasted many years. So the only important female in analysis with Freud. And she was born exactly in the period when this kind of treatment began to spread. And at a certain point during her analysis, at the end of her long analysis, she produced a circumcision sheen. The sheen of a circumcision of a gore. It is reported in one of the letters that Freud wrote to Felice. And this scene is obviously it is a combination of many elements. It seems a dream. It seems something full of fictional elements. Still, Freud, reporting this scene, remarks in brackets that a piece of her. Labium minor was still shorter today, and it closed the back. That means that an element of reality there was. And so if we consider the context and also other elements beside the context, we may come to the conclusion that this scene was a combination of reality and fantasy. That means that there was a kernel of truth in this scene. But if we assume so many things began to appear in a new light.
And of course, you make a lot of Emma Eckstein's name, which Eckstein being cornerstone in German, and in saying how this real experience of circumcision, of castration on Emma's part, and the repressed reaction of Freud to the story and everything it evoked for him is a founding stone or building block, yes, of psychoanalysis.
Yes, it is a building block because the counter-transference of Freud, and that is the emotional reaction of Freud to this female patient, was played a very important part in a series of dreams that became part of the interpretation of dreams. You know that the interpretation of dreams is the book through which psychoanalysis was born. And nearly all the dreams in the original version were the dreams of Freud. They were part of his self-analysis. A very strange process, because one should wonder why he began a self-analysis, why he did something like that. But things begins to become more clear when you consider that the initial dream, and then also later other dreams, were dreams of countertransference. And his countertransference toward Emma Eckstein's circumcision played a very important role.
And it seems like the opening to that for you has to do a lot with the relationship between Freud and Wilhelm Fliess and their common treatment of Emma, or the treatment of both of them, according to which she almost died when Fliess operated on her nose.
Of course, of course. This is a much debated question. I mean, when the complete correspondence, partially complete, because Freud himself destroyed all his of all the letters in his possession in 1904, and so we have only the letters by Freud to Fliess, which were preserved by the Fliess family and then acquired by Marie Bonaparte. And when these letters were first published in a complete edition, because they were already published in the 50s, but it was a very censored edition, and nothing about this case history was published. But when the complete edition was published, the element which impressed the most the readers and also the editor of these letters was this surgical operation on the nose of M. Eckstein, which was performed by Fliess, but with the agreement and compliance of Freud, as a treatment for her masturbation. And it was a sort of alternative treatment, which had to be much less cruel than the usual treatments. I mean, it was not an operation on the genitals. It was an alternative, an alternative operation. It was because according to Fliess, in the nose there were the genital spots, certain genital spots which influenced by reflex the sexual life. And the point is that when they performed this operation, in reality, what they did, and especially the meaning in the relationship between Freud and his female patient, was a repetition of her circumcision trauma. And so during this operation, Fliess forgot a ghost in the nose of Emma, and she risked to die, in the presence of Freud, who was very shocked. And this shock reappeared in the founding dream of psychoanalysis, the Irma dream. The dream of Irma's injection, that Freud had in the summer of 1895. And in the first scene of this dream, there is this patient, a patient who comes complaining many pains on her body, and Freud asked her to open the mouth, and when she opens the mouth, he's very scared and shocked and steps back. And in the association, this mouth is a sort of vagina, or better, a vulva. At the point that some scholar defined this dream, not only a post-traumatic dream with respect to the shock that Freud had before the Emma incident, but also a gynecological dream, no? And this gynecological shock can be understood exactly if we consider that the operation on the nose was a repetition of the childhood drama, that is the circumcision endured by M. Eckstein.
And of course you argue that it's also a repetition of Freud's trauma, whether it is his circumcision or the circumcisions of his two brothers, Julius, who died in as a result of his circumcision, and Alexander.
Yes. I mean, it is not a repetition of this trauma, but certainly there are, here we have to consider an important element of the scene produced by Emma later, the beginning of 1897, this circumcision scene. The fantastic element of this scene are especially the one concerning the sucking of the blood after the mutilation. Now, this element is an element of the Orthodox Jewish ceremony of circumcision, in which the mohel, that is the person who operates, makes the operation, after the circumcision of the newborn child, sucks his penis to stop the bleeding, and so this element of the sucking of the blood, it is part of the scene produced by M. Eckstein. What does it mean, this? What are the there are many implications, but certainly one of these implications is that Freud was reminded of the same ceremony with the same procedure which was the ceremony of his younger brother Alexander when he had 10 years. He was 10 years old. And this moment was very important in his life, because immediately after, short after, there was the episode of his disillusion with his father, Jacob. This would open up another scenario, but just let's keep in mind that he was disappointed by the feminine passive attitude of his father when an anti-Semite kicked him out of the street and humiliated him, throwing away his new cap. This was on Sabbath when he was going to the synagogue. And this was a story that his father told him, probably for to let him understand how the time were changed. It was a very human story, but the reaction, Sigmund's reaction was of disillusion and disappointment and toward his father. I think that this disappointment is better, can be better understood, taking up into account that the previous sort of rejection of the ceremony, Orthodox ceremony of circumcision of his brother Alexander. And the problem of the relation between Sigmund and his father Jacob have very much to do with the question of circumcision. Why? Because Freud, this is well known, rejected all religious ceremonies. It was part of his complete rejection of religion in favor of his illuminated view based on science. So religion is a mean of as the glue which keep together the society was replaced by science in Freud's view. And but the problem began to become to take its shape when Freud began to have his children, his male children, and he did not let them enter in the pact with God through the ceremony, the Brit Milah, which literally means the pact of the cut. It is through circumcision, because the circumcision is in Jewish religion is the proof that you are part of this community of this alliance with God. And so Freud did not have failed to have his children circumcised. And after the second child in 1891, Jacob, his father, decided to present him the old family Bible. Covered with a new skin, and with a dedication to his son Shlomo. It was the name, the Jewish name of Sigmund. And in order to remind him his duties, his religious duties. Of course, he does not say you have not circumcised your children, but the message, the strong message, was this: that he did not fulfill his duties.
And how did Freud cope with that?
badly. This was the place, the real place where psychoanalysis was born. All psychoanalysis was a meditation about the relation with the father, the rebellion to the father, and the deferred obedience to the father. The fact that the voice of the father later enter in your mind and force you in a certain way. No, you introject your father's voice. And this is very much part of the story. Why? Because the circumcision of his patient, female patient, reminded this voice to Freud, reminded him that he did not have his children circumcised. And this is the beginning of the conflict, a conflict which go through his dreams.
I've been wondering, because you've been called the master detective at deciphering Freud's emotional world, but I believe that you really choose to focus at the intersection of Freud's emotional world with Emma's emotional world, with his father's emotional world.
Exactly. There is an intersection. There is an intersection. There is an identification. In the Irma dream, this identification is... has also a localization, because in the first scene Irma enters the house of Freud, complaining of his pains, her pains, and Freud asks her to open the mouth to check what is going on, and. In the second scene, he is assisted by a few doctors who make a collective visit of Irma. And during the visit, at a certain point, they find a piece of skin infiltrated on the shoulder of this patient. And Freud says that he felt in his own body this without any distance, the touching of this point. This is the point of the identification of Freud with Irma. And As a scholar, Jay Geller, in a book on Freud's Jewish body, mitigating circumcision, clarified this identification. With circles around the piece of skin, and speaking of a Jewish and gender coded identification with Irma, which obviously becomes more clear when we consider that Irma had been circumcised. So this is something that Geller did not consider. He came to this conclusion only based on the textual reading. He is a professor of Hebrew literature and is not a psychoanalyst, and he did not consider that Emma had been circumcised. He came to this circumcision. He comes to this conclusion, which a good conclusion, but it is even more meaningful, considering that Emma had been circumcised, so that the intersection between Freud and his patient was exactly this topic of circumcision. But we have to consider another element. We are speaking as though M. Eckstein was Irma. We know that Irma was another person. It was Anna Hammerschlag, that is the daughter of the teacher of Hebrew of Freud when Freud was a boy. And all the dream the originate from the complaints of this old teacher, who is not only a paternal figure, but was a friend of the father, and certainly he shared with the father of Freud the criticism against the fact the criticism for the Freud's failure of circumcising his children. So that the complaint of Professor Hammerschlag are the beginning of the Irma dream. Freud, after having received these complaints by a friend who visited him the night before the dream, began to write the case history of the daughter of Professor Hammerschlag, Irma, in order to justify himself. And he was awake for a long time during the night, and he at a certain point he stopped to writing because his rheumatism on his left shoulder began to hurt. And in the dream, it is exactly this point, the piece of skin on the shoulder of Irma, who is detected as the point which is infiltrated and the point of the identification of Freud with M. What is the meaning of this reproach? What was the reproach of the real reproach of Professor Hammerschlag or of his father? The reproach of not having circumcised his children. And this reproach during the dream work combined with the case history of M. Eckstein. And here we find another very important detail. When Irma arrives in the house of Freud, Freud immediately says, "It's if you have pains, this is your fault, because you did not accept the solution." No.
You were not a good patient,
yes.
As Lacan says about yes. This Irma injection.
You did not
dream.
Accept the solution, he says. And then what is the solution? The solution, at the end, it is a magic word. It is a magic word, which is the work of the dream which created this world. And it is triggered by the smell of amyl. the friend who visited him the night before brought to him a bottle of a liqueur who had a terrible smell, a smell of a meal. And Freud immediately gave this present to some servant and got rid of him. That is, he got rid of the reproach of Professor Hammerschlag and got rid of this Amil. And in the dream, the Amil was transformed into trimethylamine, which is the solution of the dream, a magic word, a sort of magic word. But in
magic, both in English and in German, solution being the substance injected and the solution to the problem, and as well as Lösung.
Exactly. And but if we understand this trigger, Amil, as the Hebrew word Mila. You know that for the unconscious, Freud words were very frequently turned over or scrambled. That for the unconscious, there is an identity, a sort of identity of this process. And the problem of wording in this dream is extremely important because there are certain words like Otto, which is which can be read in the same way in a way and the other. And there is also the name Anna that can been read is the same, remains the same reading from left to right and to right to left.
So Amme, Freud's wet nurse, being read backwards becomes Emma.
Exactly. Amme, Emma. This is also something very important. But so the point is that if we start with this trigger and we consider Mila as the trigger instead of Amil. So the end of this, there is a chain of words that it cannot be repeated here, but at the end of this chain of words, trimethylamine, which is a word which appears in front of the eyes of the dreamer as letter, as bold letter, as a sort of command. It is a command. It is a verdict. And this, what are the letters that arrived to him? Well, it can be read as an anagram of Brit Mila, trimethylamine. And so this is the command that to fulfill his religious duties. That comes from the voice of the father represented in this dream by Professor Hammerschlag, the professor of Hebrew. And so the question of circumcision is very central to this dream.
I have so many more questions left, but I'm afraid we've taken a lot of your time. So to conclude, I would like to ask what you're working on now.
Well, I'm trying. So my research was very took a lot of time, and I had many doubts, and I had to study many things. And in fact, these two books, there are a lot of there is a lot of material which is sometimes not so necessary. And so I'm trying now to figure out a very a simple version of these two books, in which I go in a very clear and focused way to the nodal points of my thesis. And I'm working on this now.
That sounds quite promising for our second interview, in which we're going to discuss the second volume of this sequel. And I'm looking forward to that. It was a great pleasure speaking to you today, and thank you.
Thank you, Vera. Yeah.